Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 15, season 1, I was so happy to be able to speak with one of the world's foremost klezmer musicians, Alicia Spiegels. She was a founding member of the Grammy-winning Klezmatics, and she also played a major role in the revival of klezmer fiddling, which had been on the brink of extinction until she recorded her debut album, Fiddle, in the 1990s. Alicia is so engaging both as a player and a conversationalist, and she's full of stories from her life and career. You'll hear about her early days traveling and meeting musicians all over the world, and she also played some wonderful tunes for us as well during the episode. In a couple of bonus episodes, you can hear our little improvs back and forth. All these episodes are available as videos, and the link is in the description. Hello, and welcome to Alicia Spiegels, klezmer violinist, and I'm just so excited you're here to join me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to see your fiddle in your hands. So what would you like to play for us to start off?
I'll play a little medley of klezmer fiddle stuff. I'll start with a free improvisation in the style of a Zugers, which I could explain what that is later, followed by kind of a medium dance tune, and I'll end with something fast.
Alrighty, tap dance.
Thank you.
So right before we started recording, I asked if you knew what you were going to play, and you said you didn't know what you were going to play.
I'm a little indecisive. But it helps to have to play in the moment, because then the decision gets made.
So why was she crying out to her father? You said, "Oi, tate."
Ah, well, a lot of klezmer tunes have this "Oi, tate" shout chorus. And tate in Yiddish culture context is God.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
Oh, daddy.
Yeah.
And it's usually a complaint, you know, not so much a cry of joy or anything. But the "Oh, daddy" shout chorus is a thing in klezmer historically.
So not everyone listening will be familiar with the word klezmer. So if you wanna just speak to that.
Sure. So klezmer is traditional East European Jewish folk music. It's music that originated with Yiddish-speaking Jews in Eastern Europe, in Russia, Romania, Poland, and thereabouts, and came to the United States and probably Canada too, Montreal maybe. With immigration in the late 19th, early 20th century, and became kind of a new world ethnic folk music form as well, and added the influences of early jazz and so forth, only in the instrumentation, not musically so much, but and it's music that faded out a bit in the mid 20th century as the Jewish community assimilated, and but then it picked up steam again, starting in the 1970s with a big folk revival, which paralleled other revivals of the time. And I've been part of that since the 1980s.
Yeah, and the word klezmer is a Yiddish word that comes from the Hebrew. I believe it means like instrument of melody or something.
Yeah, it means vessel of song.
Okay.
But it's a Yiddish word, and I'm not sure that, you know, Yiddish speakers even thought about the etymology, even though, you know, that fact is sort of explained a lot, but it's just an etymology, really. The word klezmer in Yiddish means musician. Mm-hmm. So there didn't used to be any such music as klezmer music, because it was just music.
Yeah.
They didn't, and then later it became klezmer music because it was the music that klezmers played.
Great deal of cross-pollination with styles in Eastern Europe, I would think.
Yeah, well, you know, that's always true of all music everywhere, unless, you know, you can find a very isolated mountain pass which has been cut off from the rest of the world. So like all kinds of music, musicians love to interact even when everybody else in their world is fighting with the other neighboring, you know, communities or groups. Musicians are managing to play together. And so the kind of old religious, liturgical, kind of ancient scales and sounds that form the basis and the core of klezmer music encountered the neighboring folk music of non-Jewish Ukrainians and Romanians, and Jews started to play those tunes in very typically, specifically Jewish ways, which made them sound unlike how the musicians were playing them, who they learned them from, such as Romanian shepherd flute players and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the klezmer repertoire as it is today reflects all of that mixing it up that took place, especially in places like Odessa, which was a very cosmopolitan city. It was very much like New York, for example. There were Turks, Romanians, Greeks, Jews, and In the 1980s, I used to hang out at a place in the East Village in Manhattan which was just like that. It was a Moroccan Jewish restaurant called Cafe Mogador. And literally there were Armenians, Turks, Jews, Greeks among the musicians, and then everybody came and danced together. And that was what Odessa was like in the 19th century. So Odessa is a big birthplace of klezmer music and of also of the cantorial singing style that we think of as like real old school cantorial singing. And it's got a lot of Turkish modes and timbres and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. While you still have your fiddle in your hand, maybe we could talk about some of the specifically klezmer ornaments that are used. I even wrote down some of the Yiddish words because I think there's like, krechs really literally means like groans, right?
Krechs is a squeeze, literally, I think, like as if
like
you're
a kvetch is this.
And go, oi.
Krechs
means a kind of go, oi, yeah.
And a knetch?
Same thing, really.
Yeah.
Knetch is more, it's
a
actually.
Bend.
That's a musical term in, more in the Hasidic world.
Okay.
And the krechs is kind of the same thing.
So while you're just having your violin in your hand, can you just show us some of that?
Sure. So here's a krechs. So this is a krechs. And this is another kind of krechs. Those are my two favorite kinds of krechs.
Yeah. You have had such an amazing career, and I want to talk about lots of different elements, but it might be interesting to talk about, you mentioned the East Village. So I believe when you joined the Klezmatics, you answered an ad.
Yeah.
In 1985.
In the Village Voice.
Yeah.
Which was where young musicians just out of college would go to look for gigs and bands forming. And somebody was forming a klezmer band, and I answered the ad, and so did a couple of other people. Frank London answered it, and Lauren Sklamberg, and that's how we all met. And the guy who placed the ad disappeared after a week or so, never to be heard from again, a clarinetist. And then we went on to form the Klezmatics.
And you were a founding member. You were with them for many years. You performed all over the world. And you also made a couple of albums with Yitzhak Perlman.
Yeah.
So do you have any like really special memories from that time?
Oh yeah. He recorded a couple of tunes that I wrote, which was, you know, incredibly flattering since I grew up kind of worshiping him as a violin demigod. So one of them was the Dybbuk Shares, which I wrote for our incidental music for Tony Kushner's Dybbuk play, which was produced at the Public Theater in New York. So we were the on-stage and pit orchestra band, and we wrote a bunch of original music for it, and this was a tune that I wrote. And we played it as a duet. We went back and forth with the melody, and we recorded it that way in the Fiddler's House. And then I think it was also on the live album that we did. And that was incredible because, you know, we played places we never would have played otherwise, in giant theaters like Radio City Music Hall and Wolf Trap, and along with other bands, the Klezmer Conservatory Band and Andy Statman, and us, and oh my God, who was the fourth band? Brave Old World. Middle-aged moment. So the four bands would, you know, all caravan together with Perlman and play these incredible places. And I wrote another tune called The Healthy Baby Girl Horror, which I wrote for documentary filmmaker Judith Helfand's film about DES. And we also did that as on the second album, I think, Live in the Fiddler's House.
DES?
Yeah, she, DES is a drug that was given to women.
Oh, right.
Right, in the 1960s, supposedly to prevent miscarriage, which it didn't, but it caused cancer in the the babies, yeah. I mean, later in life. And so Judith made this incredible documentary, which is autobiographical, about, and it's called The Healthy Baby Girl. And this too was part of the documentary, and he played it for the album. So that was a high point.
And in terms of when you got started, you mentioned that restaurant. I heard that you played Greek music before you got into klezmer when you were quite young.
Yeah. When I first graduated college, I found myself at a Greek nightclub in Astoria, Queens, where there was a really big Greek community and a very happening music scene with a number of these small cafes, and then bigger places, which were much more glitzy, where they would throw plates and, you know, it was very intense. So this was one of the smaller places. And I became obsessed with Greek fiddle music and trying to reproduce that really unique sound, you know, very much like klezmer, right? It has its own sound. It involves ornaments that you gotta dope out and figure out somehow. And it's really hard to learn to play with a native accent so that you can fool people into thinking you were Greek, which was my goal. I was determined to pull that one off. And I loved the music so much. And for a long time, I played in this band, this incredible Greek band, and learned Greek island music and popular music. And I was very impressed with what a living culture that was, and how like multi-generational family groups would come and stay up till 4 a.m. dancing. And it was like, wow, you know, they've really got it going on with their music. And I really wanted that for klezmer, which at the time in the 80s was still kind of, you know, being revived. And I feel like we kind of ended up doing that, and, you know, we had some success. So, but I was inspired by Greeks.
So you studied with Leon Schwartz. Was that after you did your travels? Like you went hitchhiking in Europe and Israel, or was that like before then?
I did that when I traveled like that when I was in college. So in 1983, I took a year and a half off from college. And I spent a year hitchhiking around Europe, and I went to Israel also, playing on the streets. And this was before they coined the term world music, and it was just like this weird interest of my own. And actually, I had been majoring in neuroscience before that, and the plan was to be a scientist. So I found that I met musicians from a lot of places that were playing their traditional music. So I played with Berbers in Paris, and I met these Italian, you know, it was a lot like the klezmer revival. There was an Italian folk music revival going on in the 1980s in Italy. And I spent time with those musicians in Rome and a number of other kinds of music. And I hitchhiked and I played in the street. And then when I returned to college, I changed my major to ethnomusicology. Mm-hmm. And I've been poor ever since, but happy. So so after that, and after I graduated college and I went back to New York, and I started playing in the streets again, and then the Klezmatics formed, and then I met Leon. Mm-hmm. And to come back around to Leon, and I visited him in his home in Queens and spent some time listening to him play and, you know, trying to learn from what he was doing. And I was really glad that I overlapped in time with him for that little bit of time. You know, he was already very elderly, and, you know, then he passed away.
So he was born in the Ukraine, the early part of the, is that right?
You know what, I have to look up his biography again. I thought Bukovina, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, you would know. I was just trying to remember. So he was, just so people have an idea who he was, so he could come, he learned klezmer music in New
York. Oh, yeah,
in the early part of the 20th century.
Wait, what happened to my zoo? There we go. Yes, he played in bands with gypsies, and there was a lot of interchange between gypsy and Jewish musicians back in the day, and he was in a band like that.
Let's talk about the Beregovsky collection, because we're talking about the roots of this revival and your involvement with that.
Yeah, so in the early 20th century, there was a Jewish musicologist in Kiev named Moshe Beregovsky, who was a pioneer in doing the kind of collecting that, for example, Bartok did. He sent out expeditions of his students and himself, sometimes I think, to shtetlach, small towns all over Ukraine, and they brought a wax cylinder recording device, which was already old technology at that point, but the point was it was portable. You didn't have to plug it in. And he would ask in each town to meet the most, the oldest musicians who knew the old, that were there. And he asked them to play the oldest tunes they could remember. So he was really trying to go back in time, even then, to the 19th century. And he made thousands of these field recordings, you know, just an incredible treasure, especially since very shortly afterwards, that population was almost all obliterated in the Holocaust. And what we're left with are these recordings and his transcriptions that he did along with some collaborators. And they were thought to be lost for decades. But once the Soviet Union started to open up again in the 1990s, somebody found them in the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences? It's a Ukrainian Academy archive basement. There were these boxes with the wax cylinders, which was an incredible revelation. And so, because, you know, things are complicated internationally, we've been getting a trickle of these. We still haven't heard all of them. Mm. We know they're there. And the Vernadsky Library has been releasing CDs of some of these. Many of them are songs, they're vocals, but some of them are klezmer recordings. And they are incredible. They are such a trip back in time. So at some point, in the 1980s, Mark Slobin, who's a renowned ethnomusicologist here in New York, published a book of the transcriptions, you know, without having the opportunity to hear the actual recordings. Mm-hmm. And so from the beginning of my klezmer career, I got a hold of that book, and I've been working with that material, learning it, performing it, arranging it. And at some point I made an album called Beregovsky Suite with a wonderful jazz pianist named Uli Geisendorfer, a very creative musician, where we would play these together but improvise on them, and he would take them to, you know, harmonically and otherwise to crazy new places.
So, and when I heard you live in Ottawa, where I live, it was performing this with this Yiddish silent film, The Yellow Ticket.
That's when you came, yeah. Because we went back with I went back with another film called The Ancient Law.
Yeah, so both of those projects and different collaborations, I'd love you to speak to that.
Yeah, so I've been, over the past few years, writing original new scores to perform live to silent films. And the first one I did was this amazing 1918 film called The Yellow Ticket, about a young Jewish woman who has to basically lead a double life in order to attend medical school in St. Petersburg, where women can attend, but Jews can't, and Jews can't even live there. So she poses as a non-Jew, and meanwhile, she lives in a brothel. That's her day job. So it's an incredible film, and I wrote all this new music for it and performed and toured it with pianist Marilyn Lerner, who's a new music pianist and also a klezmer person. And then I teamed up with Donald Sosin, who is a prolific silent film pianist and composer. And he brought me into his projects, and together we did three more films. one called The Ancient Law, which is about the son of a rabbi who is an actor trapped in a yeshiva bocher's, a religious Jewish boy's body. There's a secular actor trapped in there, and he runs away and he becomes an actor in Vienna. And then we did one called City Without Jews, which is about a fictional city very much like Vienna that expels all the Jews, and then everything falls apart and they invite the Jews back. So it's a kind of an eerie, you know, tale of anti-Semitism, and these are all, you know, pre-war. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're all kind of, you know, they give you the chills that way. And we just did our latest one, is which is not yet released. These are all on DVDs, by the way. Mm-hmm. But this one's going to come out soon. It's called The Man Without a World. And it's a faux silent film. It was made in the 1990s by a performance artist named Eleanor Anton from the West Coast, who was very active in the 60s and 70s in the performance arts scene there. She made this film to look like a 1920s silent film. And it's very clever, very funny, and we did the music for that too. So that's something to look out for.
Definitely. The Yellow Ticket, it was a very powerful performance, and the score was really amazing. So that was quite composed with Marilyn, right?
Yeah, everything is composed. And
but with Donald, it's more improvised, I'd heard? Like your projects with Donald Sosin are more with improvised?
No, they're also composed. They're both composed like in kind of a lead sheet way. So melodies, chord changes, you know, sometimes counter lines. But then, you know, the pianists will, it's not written out for the pianist classical style with every note defined. The pianist will, you know, create the voicings and so forth and the rhythms, and we will take off and improvise on them to an extent. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of fully composed melodies in there, though. Like Donald's incredible because he could improvise something a la Beethoven. And the setting of The Ancient Law is 19th century Vienna, and he just like will go off on a train of thought, which is pure Beethoven, except it's him, but it's just brilliant. You know, I don't know how he does that. And then I wrote a lot of, you know, very Jewish, very klezmery stuff. And we kind of fuse those styles. And
so in your current projects or things you're looking ahead, is it just klezmer style, or are you playing, doing different kinds of things?
Well, I have spent the pandemic working on my classical technique and repertoire. And so the more I do that, the more that stuff kind of filters into into my composition, but I also get a little fancier with the klezmer. So that's been really fun. I never would have done that if I hadn't been, you know, basically unemployed all year from a you know, live performance point of view. I still, you know, had some writing jobs. So I don't know where that's going to go specifically, but it's just been an incredible journey, and just so happy to be able to do it. It's been amazing. Mm-hmm. I've been working up all my violin concertos and sonatas, and fun.
And so when you were studying violin when you were a kid, I mean, it was pretty straight ahead classical. Did you want to be like a chamber musician, or did you have certain aspirations in mind when you were 13?
I wanted to be a neuroscientist.
Okay.
And I still want to be a scientist, darn it. I just haven't gotten around to it. But I loved chamber music. I went to chamber music camp, the Apple Hill Center for Chamber Music, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And I mean, it was kind of a dream. I could imagine doing that. And you know, I love a lot of different kinds of music. I love classical music, though. Mm-hmm. It's really deep in my heart.
And there, I heard you tell a story about your grandfather, songwriter.
Yeah, my grandfather was a pianist, and he was kind of a child prodigy, and he went to whatever Juilliard was called when it first started. It had a different name. Mm-hmm. He went there when he was 14, and he ended up being, you know, like a gigging pianist in the popular music world. So he played with he worked in, at some point the movie industry was in Astoria, actually the same place where the Greek nightclub was, mm-hmm. you know, as just coincidentally in Queens, and he worked in television there, and then when that moved to Hollywood, he went there, and he traveled all over the country and schlepped my father and my aunt around when they were kids. He started one of the first what we call club date offices, which are wedding bands, basically, on 57th Street in New York, which is the famous wedding band office street. And he accompanied Judy Garland, and he was on Sid Caesar's Show of Shows and Hit Parade, which were big 1940s and 50s radio and then television shows. And so he was a musician, but he died when I was 11. I got to play with him to a certain extent, and I wrote a tune and once, and he arranged it for piano. That was thrilling. He would have been scandalized to find out I became a klezmer.
You think?
Yes. Because at that time, that was like, why would you want to do that? You know, we escaped the shtetl and we can go to conservatories now. And you're deliberately playing klezmer? What, are you crazy?
So when you were, did you always have a really good ear in terms of being able to pick stuff up and imitate it when you were still in the classical world?
I don't know that I had an opportunity to do that then, but when I the way I got into klezmer in part was that when I was a teenager, clarinetist Andy Statman's wife worked for my father. He was the superintendent of arts programs in East Harlem, and she's a visual artist. And so they would come over socially, Andy and Barbara. They were in their 20s at that point. And Andy was playing bluegrass mandolin also, and he taught me to play the blues. And you know, eventually when he had his first big town hall concert with Zeff Feldman, the cymbal player, which then became his debut klezmer album, we went to that show in town hall. And in fact, I took out my violin in the lobby and tried to play for money.
Really?
I was playing like Eufen Pripachik and Yiddish songs. And I have forgotten how I got here. What was the question?
Did you heard Andy play and it was his debut album, like getting into klezmer?
The first question, what was
about playing by ear when you were still
playing by ear, right? Yeah. Right. So at that point, I started trying to learn to play by ear, like learning blues with Andy. And at some point, I fell in love with Irish music. And I used to go, there was an Irish bar called the Eagle Tavern in New York, where they would have these sessions. And I would go and try and get the melodies. So I was getting into all different kinds of music. Actually, before I went hitchhiking around Europe, what happened was, in 1979, well, I grew up in the suburbs, but then when I was 16, we moved to the city. And there was a transit strike, and the streets were crowded with people that would normally be in the subway. And I took out my violin and started playing for money. And I met there were these other buskers who were Italians who played old-timey music. They were like old-timey music fanatics. It was like me playing Greek music, you know? They didn't speak English. But they played old-timey music. And so I hooked up with them, and they were teaching me how to play old-timey style, and I was learning by ear. So I was getting into all these different kinds of music when I was a teenager, actually.
Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, for people starting out now, you know, we're like 20, it's such a different environment musically. Like, the internet's so huge, and I mean, your career is so much in a way of the time, right? That you're able to do so much traveling and so many live performances.
it was all about people, you know. Yeah. And when you're young, I mean, at least when I was young, all I wanted to do was meet more and more people and new people. I loved people. People were just the greatest. Now I've been there. But the music and the people, it was all of a piece, you know. Mm-hmm. You would meet people to play music with them, and the music was there to play with people. And so hitchhiking around Europe and meeting other musicians, it was so exciting. And now I feel like, I mean, it's incredible the access you have now. Whereas, like, even when we were touring with the Klezmatics, the big thing was, like, you land in a city and you look for the record store. Mm-hmm. Because there you could find music. There was nowhere else to find music. There was no internet. Mm-hmm. You would have to, like, go to a place and find music, you know. It was all this exciting treasure hunt. So now it's so easy. There's access to everything your heart could desire. And it would have been a dream come true at that time. If we could, we're going to plop you for a week in 2021 and you go to town with that internet, we would have been like, woo. But I feel like maybe it's all a little abstract and like up here. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe for young people today, because, you know, it's a solitary, it can be a solitary experience to get all the stuff from the internet.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so overwhelming too. And now I know if people are learning tunes by ear, they can just have a program that slows it down without affecting the pitch. I mean, you didn't used to be able to do that, right?
The amazing slower downer.
Yeah.
I love that. But yeah.
But would you have advice for young people, I mean, who are getting into, you know, different styles of music, coming out of the straight and narrow classical world?
Coming out of the classical world. Oh, what's my advice for young people? I guess it would be to try to do it with people. Like, mm-hmm. you know, do what you need to do to get up to speed to play with those people. But then, I mean, you can't say this right now, can you? When all this COVID stuff is over, go out there and play music with people. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. what
it. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. It was really wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.